All of the government programs that we don't like are funded by theft. All of the government programs that we do like... Oh, sorry, there aren't any. Government is the reason that healthcare is expensive. Government is the reason you can't go to college. Taxation is theft.
And we're live. Welcome back, everybody. Taxation is theft. Welcome. This is the show that talks about all the ways the government is ripping you off. And we're broadcasting live on Facebook and YouTube from an underground bunker deep within the jungles of Mexico. I'm Dan, Taxation is Theft Berman. I previously ran for president of the United States from a hammock in Mexico. And I'm currently running for governor of Texas from this very same hammock. You should not listen to this show if you suffer from ulcers, migraines, or high blood pressure. I have to let you know that. That's government mandated, actually. Today's guest is Nick Reed, who's got two kids who don't have birth certificates or social security numbers. This is an amazing story. How does this work? How is this possible? How can he get away with it? Ooh, what a criminal. Are these things being forced upon us without our consent? Is he forcing his kids to live a life of solitude without outside of the privilege of our civilized society? Stick around and find out. Before we get started, I just want to take a quick minute to ask you guys for your support for this podcast and all the other amazing projects that we do here. You can visit taxationistheft.cards to get one of our really awesome hats, like this one right here. So many other products we have available. We have a giant 3x5 foot taxationist theft flag that you can fly in front of your house and piss off your HOA. We've got taxationist theft stamps, so you can mark all of the Federal Reserve notes that you're putting into circulation, all that worthless paper. And we have some really awesome t-shirts like the Taxes Pay Killer Cops t-shirt that are incredibly popular right now. So head on over there. Anything you buy goes to support us, not just the podcast, but all these other projects that we're working on. These projects are generally to thwart the deceptive nature of the government with our impressive counter-propaganda campaigns. Now, on to the show. Nick. Oh, wait. Nick, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Awesome. Thanks for being here. And this is, so everybody knows we've been doing the podcast for a while. So sorry if this was a rough intro. I'm just, I'm getting back in. My studio's halfway built. I know you're working on building your studio there also. How's it going, man?
It's going fantastic. It's good to reconnect. I think your audience is really going to like this, message, especially if they're expecting parents or thinking about being parents and they're listening to your podcast. Then they're probably very interested in how can I not give my kids a tracking ID if I don't have to? And what are some of the consequences of that or trade-offs or what does that even look like? So it's not overwhelming.
Right.
I'm excited to get into it. My kids are, I have two girls, Jessica and Nora. Jessica's almost four and Nora just turned one. And both of them, we went through virtually the same process, which we'll get into, but I'll stop right there.
Awesome. Yeah, no. And it's, you know, a lot of people have reached out, as we were preparing to do this show with tons of questions like, here's a question that just came in. Do you have to pay taxes on the hat? no, we don't charge tax for anything. But questions about, you know, how do I not pay taxes? Because we talk to a lot of people on the show that are, you know, they say things like, you know, don't work for anybody where you have to give your social security number. Of course, if you don't have one, you don't have one to give. And a lot of it, that's what it all comes down to. Because I think a lot of people understand that when we give money to the government in any form, whether it's paying a tax or, you know, whether it's a hidden tax or a voluntary tax or anything else, we are enabling the government to do all the terrible things that it does. The war on drugs, dropping bombs on brown children in the middle of the desert in the Middle East. All these horrible things, we're paying for it. And that's typically associated with a social security number. Now, of course, you mentioned it's also a tracking number and it's used for so many other things, which are absolutely outrageous. But I think a lot of people understand that number is very central to a lot of the taxes that we're forced to pay also. So I want to let's back up and like let's kind of maybe kind of get a backstory here. Like, when you were born, did you get a birth certificate and a social security number?
Absolutely.
And so what happened along your life that you realized you didn't want to have this same thing for your kids?
I was actually working at, or I think I was volunteering at, a domestic violence hotline. And I was helping victims of domestic violence, domestic abuse, understand that what they're going through is abuse. And when their boyfriend or husband is going through their phone and their texts and requires to have, you know, and is putting tracking, you know, apps on them and requires them to tell them where they're going if they leave and all this stuff, I'm trying to explain to them and do some healthy relationship education that this isn't what makes a healthy relationship. And I'm trying to get them connected to their sense of human dignity again. And I go home after doing this advocacy work and I'm confronted with all of the daily bureaucratic tasks that we go through. And I start to see some parallels. I start to notice that what's happening in domestic abuse is paralleling the systemic abuses that we all experience every single day in our lives. And so I had this cognitive dissonance, like, my God, what do I do? You know, here I am trying to advocate for these guys. And at the same time, we're all victims of this stuff from the government's controlling abusive nature every single day, you know? And so that was the point at which I started really outlining some of those parallels and trying to figure out what I could do to try and mitigate those myself. Because it was really hard to try and tell people that this is good for them to do and then you not do it yourself once you're aware of it in your own context.
Right, like you gotta take your own advice. And this is really interesting because you see this online all the time, right? You see somebody talk about, you know, I'm in an abusive relationship, and then of course the internet trolls who they're not even trying to be trolls, they're just assholes, say, well, why don't you just leave? It's your fault for staying. And what that comes down to a lot of times is, well, I can't leave. There's financial reasons, there's kids, there's dogs, whatever the situation might be. And it's almost the same thing with government, right? Because it's like, well, if you don't like the government, I mean, of course, there's always, why don't you just move to Somalia? But why don't you just stop participating? And you can't always just stop participating because it's like, okay, well, throw away your birth certificate and your driver's license and your passport and all this other stuff. And all of a sudden, you can't interact with anybody, not just the government, but you can't interact with anybody because everybody else is like tied into the system. So there is kind of that, all of these excuses of why you can't leave. Oh, well, I'm not going to be able to get my kids into a decent school. It's my children's future. It's this, it's that, it's my job, it's my career. If I don't have a social security number, I can't work for a big corporation as an executive because they won't hire somebody without, you know, without papers. All of this stuff kind of comes into play. And I think that's very much in line with what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that people want to be proactive. People want to set their kids up for success and protect their freedom from the start. And people ultimately don't like being controlled. And so when we're confronted with the situation where you're about to have a child, right, the last thing you want to think about is all of the bureaucracy surrounding it. You don't want to think about it as a giant bureaucratic legal proceeding. You're trying to enjoy the moment and the magic. And here you are, you're about to have a baby, right? And so what happens is, without even knowing it, in your glowing glee, you sign all these papers and all of a sudden what you end up ultimately giving tracking numbers to an entire another generation who keeps doing it, who then gives tracking numbers to their kids, who again gives tracking numbers to their kids. It's very clever the way that it happens, but people are not suspecting it. And it actually takes being proactive to get ahead of this, or else you're gonna give socials to your kids and they're gonna keep doing it to theirs.
Right. Yeah. So, and this is really interesting because it's one of these things where it's the period between when you're born and you have your, you know, you get your papers done from your parents to the next, you know, let's say it could be anywhere between 16, 18, 25 years before you have your kids. All of this time passes, and this whole time we're just taught Social Security number is something that you, like, everybody has one, right? Like, and we never stop to think, well, does everybody really have one? Everybody we know has one, or maybe they don't, because that's not something that really comes. We just assume that everybody we know has one. And it becomes to that point where, okay, when we have our kids, it's like, well, everybody has one. I had one. My parents had one. Might as well, like, I don't see any problem with this. There's that perception
normalcy.
Of exactly. Normalized. That's just the way it is. Now, when you, so you decided you didn't want to do this before you had kids, of course, right?
Well, so the funny thing is, right, I decided and I thought about it and I even, had talked about it with my wife, maybe 2 or 3 or 4 years before we had kids. But by the time that we had kids, all that was in the back of my mind. And I got blindsided just like everybody else. And I'll tell you what happened. So we walk into the birthing center. It's not quite a hospital, but there's still birth attendants. And so they have all of the reporting requirements that doctors would have because they're midwives. And when Jessica was born, they started bringing us all this paperwork to sign, and it was almost immediate. And here we are holding like a newborn baby, and this baby
don't
also
want that
happens
one to, slip
to be
through the cracks, right?
Screaming right at the top of her lungs. We're trying to calm down our newborn. We're like, it's our first kid. We're wondering if something's wrong. We got all this world going on, and then comes paperwork. And so the contrast of that for me was so strong, I couldn't get over it. And there's like this instinct in me that says, it's like the yuck factor. Like, no, you can't do this. So I just reacted. I was totally reactional and said, I'm not signing your papers right now. Look, you're gonna have to come back later. Sorry, you know, no soliciting. I'm in the middle of, you know, having a baby here with my family. So they would eventually come back and again and again. And I want to tell you, these guys are fantastic. The Austin Area Birthing Center where we were, it's an amazing crew. Each one of them is an amazing person in their own right. But the fear that they have of getting in trouble, of doing something wrong, of losing their occupational license, their ability to do their own job and support their own livelihood, they feel threatened. And nobody knew, I didn't know, they didn't know that they're not gonna get in trouble. There's no requirement for them to get a signature from me. Their requirement is to ask me. And but no one knew this. And so they were literally stuffing papers, I mean this, literally handing us papers to sign through the window as we're driving away in the parking lot, chasing us out the parking lot. They were that scared of what could happen to them if they don't register these kids, meaning filling out an application for live birth and the application for the Social Security number, which goes with that and all that work. So I got blindsided myself. And what actually happened is I just reacted to the bureaucracy, and I just don't like being told I have to do something. And then later I started looking it up and figuring out and planning and making a conscious decision of how we were going to respond, because we were getting phone calls.
Right.
So that's kind of the first part of how my story starts.
Now, you said that their only requirement is to ask you to fill out the papers, not to force you or arrest you if you don't, or to physically restrain you and force you to sign it. All they have to do is ask you to sign it?
Right. They have to request a signature, and they have to present us with the paperwork. But there's the, and I wish I had the all the research I'd done in front of me. But there's no requirement for them to get a signature, which would be ludicrous anyway, because how would they? How could they possibly be held accountable for getting a signature from somebody else who might or might not give it? So It makes total sense in hindsight, but in the moment, it's quite a scary thing because it's not every day that somebody's not filling out their paperwork. I was probably the exception rather than the rule.
Right. And this is interesting too, because it's for them, it's normal. It's like clockwork, right? Every single day, a pregnant woman comes in, leaves a woman with a baby, and they sign the paperwork and they leave. So when somebody tells them, no, I don't want to sign that, that's like, wait a minute, what do we do? I can see how they might start to panic because they're like, well, I don't know what to do in this situation. They always just sign the paperwork. What do we do? Do we need to call the police? Is this illegal? Is this a crime? I don't know.
I'm going to get in trouble.
Right. And what's and really that's interesting...
food on the table for their family. That's what they're worried about. That's their livelihood. They're midwives.
Absolutely. And so I remember there was something in the news recently about, I guess midwives are, do they, there was something about a new licensing requirement for midwives that were like, when, like, cause some people have their kids at home, right? And there was like some new sort of regulation for that that they were trying to pass that sounded like, and I wish I had that in front of me, but it sounded like, so somebody goes to your house to help you deliver a child and they want to add more to that process to make sure that they're getting you into the system and they're registering. And this is really interesting too. So for everybody that's like, well, what's the big deal? It's just a certificate, right? It's just proof that somebody was born, right? I watched this, it was a movie, but it was kind of like a documentary in that they had historians basically go through and you know, make sure that the facts of this movie were very, very close to the historical truth. And it was amazing to see that it was about the Anabaptists and this whole thing and how the church, which was the government at the time, was trying to tax everybody. And so what they did is this is when they created the baptisms and they were trying to get everybody to baptize their children as they were born so they could put them in this giant book, which was a ledger of everybody who's been born, which ultimately was a tracking system so that they could tax them. And this is exactly like why the government is so adamant about making sure you have a birth certificate. It's not because they want to know how many people there are, because if that were the case, they wouldn't need a census, right? They already know exactly how many births, exactly how many people came across the border, exactly how many deaths, all this. Figure out the numbers, right? That's not it. They have a census anyway because they know this isn't accurate. But they want to get as many people into the system as possible anyway. So I guess let's talk about like, so what has this been like? What have been the consequences of this? Let me ask this first. How old are your kids now?
One and almost four.
So the four-year-old is, and forgive me because I'm not a parent and I don't know anything about this. The four-year-old is getting ready to go into school now, right?
She's in daycare. She's been through Montessori schools. She's now in another daycare, Green Monkey Village. And now she's in the Austin Forest School. And so I call it her wilderness therapy program for troubled toddlers.
And is this like what happened when you took her there? Was there a requirement that, well, we need to see a social security card or something? We need to know that these kids are yours. How do we know you didn't steal these kids from someone else? Was there any of that sort of thing going on?
No, I don't think so. I do think there's maybe a line for it on the application if they use a standard application like the Montessori school did. For this daycare, there's no requirement on a daycare to get a social security number from you in order to accept your kid as a requirement of their school license, if they're licensed. Most people just offer it. They are required, I think, to get some form of identification from the parent. and they need to know who's on the list of who can pick a kid up and who can drop a kid off, right? So they track that and make sure everybody's on the approved list. And then daycares also, I think, maybe they run background checks also on the parents, looking for crimes usually related to children and violence or sexual offenses. Okay. And things like that. Yeah, but so, there's no requirement to use a social. Now, the question is there a requirement to have a social? Do you have to have a social to get government benefits, right? So like public school would be a public benefit. Getting your Social Security money would be a public benefit. And all the there are things that you are required to have Social Security number for to get a benefit. One of the surprising things that I didn't realize until it happened was that there's a tax deduction that people get for their kids. You write people off as dependents. And the IRS, they only recognize your tax ID, which for individuals is your Social Security number. So you can't write that off. And then it recently changed to where you get a child tax care credit. I think it's like $2,000 a kid or something like that. Well, you can't do that. But I have been told by my previous accountant that you can still apply and get it. You can get up to $500 for someone who doesn't have a tax ID, who's a dependent. But you have to send it in the written form. Most accountants use accounting software, and the software has a mandatory data box for a Social Security number, so it won't accept it. It won't be able to send in the application without it. But you can still do it in the written form. And most things are like that as well.
Right, and that's really interesting too, because everybody thinks, you know, you have to do the 1040 form. And the truth is, if you read, I think it's even the instructions on the back. It's in the, there's like an instruction booklet that comes with the 1040 form. And in there, it tells you, if you are a person, not that everybody has to pay income tax, but if you are a person who is supposed to be paying the income tax, you must send in either the 1040 form or a statement. And this is something that's brought up by a lot of people who advocate using, one of the other 1040 forms. So not the 1040 or the 1040 EZ, but like the 1040 NR for non-resident aliens, not non-resident because you live outside of the United States, but because you live outside of Washington, DC and its territories, which under that rule makes you a non-resident alien. But it's I think that's very similar to the way, like, because if you go to the IRS website, I'm pretty sure they just tell you, like, yeah, no, you have to fill out a 1040. You go to an accountant and you say, hey, I want to do my taxes. They fill you out a 1040. They don't ask you, do you want to use the 1040 NR? They don't ask you any of these questions. They just assume, well, this is what everybody else does. This is the easy way. This is the simple way. We're going to do this for you this way. And I think that's, you know, especially when you have software that the software is developed by people who think, oh, well, everybody has a Social Security number, so we'll just make this field mandatory. It kind of reinforces that, but it's there's not necessarily a time where you always have to fill that out. It's not mandatory in real life. It's just mandatory based on the software and the people who are pressuring you to put all that information in there.
That's right. So we have to go into the conspiracy around this.
Okay.
There is conspiracy around the Social Security number and the birth certificate, right? Have you heard a couple?
I've heard a couple. I've heard that they're stored at the Federal Reserve as collateral for a debt. I've heard that your Social Security number is an account at the Federal Reserve Bank. It's an account number. I don't personally buy into either of those. Although I do believe that we as individuals are indirectly being held as collateral for the national debt, because of course they just look at the government's income, how much money, like any business.
Well, the national debt's the people's debt.
Yeah, well, it's not mine. I'm not paying it. But it's the government has to pay it. And what's the government's source of income? It's me, right? They got to milk me.
That's right. That's so, right.
Yeah. So,
but I want to talk about it because we're going to get into what you can use to establish identity and citizenship as an alternative to a birth certificate and a social security number, and how you can live a virtually seamless life as a family in society without this stuff that is required for everything. So but when we talk about this, what naturally comes up, especially for this kind of audience, is, wow, well, what else is there that we just don't know about, that if we just knew the right process that maybe we could get out of, that maybe there's actually this parallel path, right? That maybe the ultra uber, you know, elite and connected use, where there's just a free, there's just freedom and free life, and we can live an unhindered, untethered life free of tyranny if we just know how to apply or get the right forms in, or walk like this and talk like that, right? And it's total bullshit.
Right. Well, this, I mean, that's the thing. It's like,
this is okay. Like, what we're going to talk about is legitimate, but there's a whole giant conspiracy and lots of gurus popping up, applying this principle of don't make assumptions to an even another further level of, like, you can get out of being a citizen, and they're okay with it if you just know the right words.
Right. Yes, as some people like to say, casting a spell, because words are spelled. I know people who are like, they follow that philosophy almost as if it's witchcraft, but which I don't believe. But at the same time, I totally understand how the government creates alternate definitions for certain specific words. And, you know, and depending on how you use those words and in what context, completely alters the course of what decisions they're going to make. And a lot of times the people administering this, whether it's clerks or judges, they don't even understand. They don't even understand what these words mean or why they're different. But all they know is, oh, they said this word, it goes into box A, and they said the other word, it goes into box B. That's literally all they know. And it's amazing how much impact that has on just all of this.
So let's get into one of the conspiracies. Let me ask you, what direction would you actually like to go in this podcast?
I want to hear the conspiracies. For anyone who knows me going far back enough, one of the reasons I kind of got into this movement was I heard a lot of really good conspiracies, but some of them were too good to be true. So I started investigating them to find out what's real and what's not. So I really love that. I really love hearing about conspiracy theories, but not just like the theory itself, but actually, okay, how much of this is true? So let's go in that direction.
So, like most conspiracy theorists, I've only got part of the picture, right? Or the story. But the conspiracy theory, as I understand it, is that there's two kinds of law. There's the law of the land, and then there's the law of the seas, which is called maritime law. And in maritime law, which is about commerce, right, when a ship comes into a port, comes into what's called the berth, it has to present what's called a certificate of berth, right? And this lists all of the assets that are being presented when they arrive at the port that are being unloaded. And that way, for tax purposes, everything can be tracked and accounted for, and you know. And this process, the theory goes, is the same process that's been used to organize and track and tax human beings, right? In a completely different jurisdiction than people are aware of. And we've all been duped. And so the idea is that when a human being is born or birthed, right, there's the requirement to put a application of live birth in is a maritime proceeding, which then registers this human being in a different jurisdiction, in the maritime jurisdiction, or it creates a fictitious person in this different jurisdiction that then is taxed and, you know, all this stuff, right? The taxpayer as a person. And if you can just not get registered. If you don't have a birth certificate, if you don't have a social security number, then the theory goes that you are not subject to all of the laws that go along with that, that everybody else does. Because it's not actually you that is being controlled, right? It's this person. Because this fictitious person or trust or whatever was created by the government, therefore they own it. Therefore, that's why it makes sense that we have all this control and 35 million laws and rules that apply to it. It's their property, but it doesn't apply to me, the living man, the person, right? And so if I just learn to walk like this and talk like that, then there's going to be no one who's going to bother me with control anymore, right? Government's going to leave me alone. They're going to respect my human dignity, respect my autonomy as an individual, and I'm going to go about my life and live happily ever after.
Sounds wonderful.
It does, doesn't it? The problem is the government doesn't give a shit about what you think. The control is greater than any individual politician or bureaucrat in the institution of government. Control is not something that's exclusive to the institution of government and people that work within it. Control is something that happens every single day to every single person listening to this podcast and on this podcast right now at every moment. We're always battling with whether or not we can let go of control or whether we're going to be controlling of other people, whether or not we're going to let people find their own path to the same destination or whether or not we're going to dictate how they should get there. This is something that people do with their spouses of how they should raise children or with their employees of how they should do their job. This is something that we do in school with telling people how they should think and what's important to learn, regardless of what they're interested in. This is something that everybody is susceptible to. And so to just project this idea that control is always about the other fella, never about me, makes us one, incredibly blind to it, but two, it operates in the dark. And then it's happening and we're not even aware of it, so we're not even in a position to be able to change it in the place where we have the greatest locus of control, which is ourselves, right?
Right.
So I think this is a great myth, but I think it's a dangerous myth. The myth of the fictitious person trust, if you walk like this, you can get out of it thing.
And because here's what I've always seen about that. Like I've been to court a million times and I've tried something similar to that argument.
Me too.
And ultimately I had the case dismissed. At first I got laughed out of court and said, yeah, forget this motion to dismiss. We're not going to hear it. And then the next appearance, they were like, yeah, we're dismissing this case in the interest of justice. Now, I have some people telling me, oh, that's because the conspiracy worked. At the same time, I'm like, there is no recorded case history anywhere in the entire country in any court that says, oh, well, somebody walked out of court because they said they are not the person with the social security number, and so therefore the law doesn't apply, and they were able to walk out of court. That's never happened. So if that is the case, then you have this massive conspiracy. It would, and no conspiracy ever lasts when it's got this many people involved. You've got this massive conspiracy of every court, every judge, every prosecutor who basically says, oh, if they say these magic words, we have to let them walk on out of here. And that makes absolutely no sense. Not only that, not only do we have to let them walk on out of here, we have to pretend that we're not letting them walk out because they said those words. We have to pretend that we're letting them walk out because of something else. That's absolute insanity.
And what's to keep someone, I mean, fraud and abuse happens all the time. What's to keep them, even if that was the real rules and name of the game, from just saying, screw this, I make the rules, who are you? And doing whatever they want. See, when I tried this stuff in court, that's exactly what happened to me. I had a traffic citation for violating the following distance. I got into a fender bender, got into an accident, rear-ended somebody. And because seconds before impact, I obviously touched the car, I violated the following distance. So afterwards, some good Samaritan called a police officer as we were exchanging our information. And he showed up and wrote me a ticket for following too close. So I thought it was utter bullshit, and I took it to court, and I started researching, and I actually found some gurus who enlightened me, initiated me into this wonderful freedom mythology that of maritime law, right? And so I armed myself with legalese and maritime language and tradition and ritual, and I walked into this courtroom like a wizard. And I'll tell you what happened. I did everything by the books. And what I mean is, it's a promise to appear by a certain date. So I appeared early and no one was there to see me. So I just had him sign it. I declared that I was walking into common law jurisdiction as I walked past the bar or the sandbar, which the theory says you enter the ocean in maritime law of the seas then when you pass the bar. When they call out your name, I didn't say I'm that fictitious person, right? I said, no, I'm the authorized representative here to handle this matter, right? When they asked me, how do I plead? I didn't plead. I said, I'm here by way of special appearance to challenge the court's jurisdiction, right? So I showed up and on special appearance day, and they had a judge. He was a sit-in judge. I didn't know that. He was also head of the philosophy department where I was studying and oversaw whether or not I was going to graduate. I didn't know that either. And so he said, well, how would you like to handle this matter? And I said, well, I motion for dismiss. And he said, on what grounds? And I said, well, we haven't established in personam nor subject matter jurisdiction, which is from civil court, not from criminal, but I'm applying it that way because that's what the theory says to do. So you have to establish jurisdiction over the fictitious person. You have to prove that they are that fictitious person. That's the in personam jurisdiction, right? So he says, are you a lawyer? I say, no, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not here per se. I'm here pro per, you know, to challenge the court's jurisdiction. So we go back and forth. We do all this. He says, okay, you don't have to enter in a plea, but by Texas law, I can enter in a plea for you. I'm going to put in a plea of not guilty and trial by jury. Get out of here. And I was like, I object and all this stuff. And he doesn't care. And he wrote it off and he said, I'm sorry. That's what I got to do. And he walks out. Now, in the theory, right, they say, if he leaves the courtroom, you win the battle. Well, there was a hearing. There was another arraignment that was scheduled for me, whether I liked it or not, or whether so I show up and now it's another judge, right? And he's not as patient with me at all. So he says, are you Nick Reed? And I do the same spiel. And he says, were you driving on this road at this time and got in this accident? And I have another little slippery spiel. And he says, all right, you want to play games, don't you? You want to play games with me, boy? And I say, no, sir, I'm just here to exercise my rights. He goes, oh, yeah, well, you try this in court. We're going to get you. We're going to get you good. Uh-huh. I'm going to write in trial, not guilty, and trial by judge. And you see how you like it. I'm going to get you contempt of court, blah, 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 blah. Right? Fine. Whatever. I'm still sticking with the myth that maybe all this is real. And if I just talk with the magic words, then I can get my way out, right? So I show up on, I've requested discovery to make sure that they didn't have any evidence or see what they had on me, and there was no discovery. And I show up and walk in, sit down, and he says, prosecutor ready, defender ready? Okay, let's go. And I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. Whoa, what's this? There's an envelope on my desk. The prosecutor just set down, right? And it's a verified complaint. So according to this theory, right? And this kind of bolstered the theory a little bit. So I'm like, mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, maybe this is all real. They don't have the jurisdiction to hear the case unless they can establish in personam or subject matter jurisdiction, or there's a verified complaint by somebody who's an injured victim who's claiming injury by me and asking for the state to prosecute and take the case, right? So here's this verified complaint that I was saying they had to have. And if they didn't have it, then they didn't have jurisdiction, right? Over the subject matter. So I read this thing And I'm like, who is the complainer? My insurance company already paid for the little fender ding. Who's complaining to the state? And it's signed by the clerk. And you know who notarized it? The clerk right next to him. And it's being presented in a court of law.
Right.
And it was that point at which I realized I'm still trying to beat this by the rules of the game. And they're not, there are no rules for these guys. They don't care. They make up the rules as they go. And then this document is like just the most incredible revelation to me that I can't beat this by playing the game and within the system. I'm going to have to play outside of it. I'm going to have to play the human card. So I had a trial by jury. I showed them that bullshit. They unfortunately didn't know what we were talking about. What fraud? Right. What is this thereby complaint? I've never heard of this. And, you know, we tried to do the whole jury nullification bit, which they've also never heard of and don't understand. And so they said, look, we know this is bullshit. We just want to give you defensive driving. And being the hard ass I was, I said, absolutely not. I refuse to accept that. You need to make a decision. So they said, you know what? Screw you. And they hit me with a maximum penalty of a few $100 and whatever it was, and guilty. Right. And I walked out of there and I lost the case, but I learned and graduated from this mythology that the systems are in place for your freedom and you just have to master the rhetoric.
Right. Well, so, okay, I want to throw in my two cents on this because I hear the story and I agree with a lot of what you're saying, but I also think there's a little bit of a difference there. So for one thing, the Patriot mythology comes from different states that have different rules. So I can tell you in California, they absolutely do have, and they don't even try to hide it. They have a jurisdiction that is neither criminal nor civil, right? And if you look in the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, it only talks about criminal and civil. I don't even know if it mentions maritime in there. But it says in criminal cases, you have a right to trial by jury. In civil cases, you have a right to trial by jury if it's over $10. When you get a traffic citation in California, they don't take you, like Texas, they take you to a criminal court.
Yeah,
in California, they don't take you to a criminal court or a civil court. They call it administrative jurisdiction, right? Which, now, the Patriot mythology is interesting because they say, well, if it's not criminal and it's not civil, it must be maritime.
Look at the tassels on the flag.
Yeah, but like, where do you get that? That's like, this is not a potato, this is not a tomato, therefore it must be an apple. That's like, right. That doesn't make any sense.
It's a stretch.
Right. And so in that way, there are a lot of things that they do, and I've broken that process in California, and I'm sure in Texas it's different. And the reason they do this is for all the same reasons. It's, you know, there is nothing in the California Constitution or the Texas Constitution that says they can make a crime out of something like not following a speed limit, following too close, making a turn without a signal. They don't have that authority. So what they do is they get you, oh, well, let's get a license, right? And I've been driving without a license, and I think you would be on board with that, with, you know, not having social security numbers and birth certificates, not having a license. Now, here's what's really interesting. If you get a traffic ticket and let's say you're convicted, you're charged, whatever, and you don't pay it, this is not civil jurisdiction. This is not criminal jurisdiction. In California, they don't just go into your bank account and take the money. In Texas, they don't either. In Texas, I know one person who was, he had some unpaid tickets, and they said, oh, you have unpaid tickets, we're going to arrest you. They put him in the back of the police car, and then they handed him a credit card machine and said, if you give us a credit card, we'll let you go. They try to extort this money out of you, and one of the things that they have to do to threaten you is, because you have this contract with them, this driver's license, they can say, oh, you breached the terms of the contract by following too close, and you never paid us the money that you owe for that. So we're going to suspend your license. And now if you're caught driving with a suspended license, that's escalated, right? Now they say, oh, that's a bigger issue. That's a bigger penalty. And they at some point turn it into a crime. Oh, well, he's not appearing to court, even though he signed the contract. And then they say, you know, basically that's aligned with contempt of court. And then it gets into the area where they can actually like commit acts of violence against you, saying like, oh, we're going to put you in a cage and all this other stuff. So there is a little bit of truth to that, but the Patriot mythology doesn't really separate. They it's almost like they take different stuff from different states and then they combine it together into one thing and say this works anywhere. And it's like, no, in some states it all works differently. And it's not like you can just walk in there and say the magic words, but in some cases it is. So let me give you an example in California when I had this one case and I tried something very similar and I said, you don't have any jurisdiction. This is actually, when you have a real civil lawsuit, somebody has to file what's called the complaint, which is that's how the case gets initiated. And in the complaint has to be a statement of jurisdiction. Who am I? Who is the person I'm suing? Who's the defendant? Why is this court the right place to have this trial? Why is this the right court, whether it's criminal or civil, to have this trial? You have to have a statement of jurisdiction describing what the cause of action was. Why is there a lawsuit in the first place? And why does this court have jurisdiction over that matter? And at any point, and it's very true that once you file a complaint in a civil court, the judge can look at it and say, I don't think this court has jurisdiction. And they can say, we're going to send it to another court. Or the defendant can say, I don't think this court has jurisdiction, and challenge that. And if the judge has to look at the information and say, okay, well, this is why they say it has jurisdiction, this is why they say it doesn't, the judge has to make a determination whether or not the court has jurisdiction. If they make the wrong determination, it can be appealed. But if nobody brings up the issue, neither the defendant or the judge says this court does not have jurisdiction, then basically it's like an oversight and it's like, okay, well, nobody paid attention to that. We're going to start going into the next process.
It's assumed that the court has jurisdiction.
Exactly. Because nobody challenged it. And it's
acquiescence by omission.
Exactly. And it's very interesting that this is true for a lot of things like evidence. If somebody submits evidence, like let's say a cop gets up on the stand and he says something, right? I saw him following too close. That is assumed as fact until, and then of course, then it totally gets subjective after that point where, you know, well, okay, somebody's contradicting it. Who do I believe? But it's assumed as fact unless somebody objects to it or refutes it, right? So another witness has to get on the stand and say, no, that's not what happened. And then people get to make their own decision. But until that happens, it is assumed that that is fact. If there is a piece of evidence submitted, the judge has to accept that evidence unless somebody objects. So this works like throughout the courts as like part of the whole process. So some of these parts are true, but like I said, and like you said in your story, there's a lot of it that you can't just, it's almost like, okay, there's a bunch of little bits and pieces that are true, but then they take them all together and then they throw some like magic fairy dust on it and say like, oh yeah, yeah. And just, and tell them Bob sent you and you'll walk right out of there. Like no problem.
Let me clarify, cause it's not exactly as black and white as I just painted it. If you walk into court and you don't speak any legalese, you cannot defend your rights unless you have a good lawyer. The legal system is too complicated for layman terms, and they use their own language. They have a book called Black's Law Dictionary, which is that thick, full of words that replace all the words that you use every single day.
That's just the way it is.
And there are lots of proceedings and things that you can do that will work out in your favor. What is bullshit for me is the myth behind it. And I don't mean that the very specific things that we're talking about are a myth in the sense that a myth, like a lie. I mean the mythology. I mean the underlying belief system, the story that if I can learn just the right way of filing my papers, then there really are not the actual threats and consequences of disobedience to the powers that be.
That's exactly what the legalese is, though. So I think you're right to an extent, but I think there's also, like, especially when it comes to mythology, that way of doing it is totally different from what it is in the real world. Do you think that's fair to say? So, like, for example,
I know what you're saying. I think we're talking a little bit past each other, but I totally agree with you. I do totally agree with you.
And this is, we're using different words incorrectly. Yeah. It's okay. So I want to go back to, So I had somebody ask me a question. How do I not pay income taxes? And I told him, well, if the IRS doesn't have any information about you, and you don't give them any information, then there is nothing to tax. Now, whether or not that's legal and right, I don't want to get into that. But if you don't have an employer who is reporting on your social security number, right? Now, they don't just send the information. And again, this goes back to, you know, what happened with the midwives, where your employer's obligation is to ask you for a social security number. It is not to refuse to hire you until you give them one. And when you give it to them, you put it on a tax withholding certificate, which is not just here's my information. It is, I certify that this income will be taxable and you are supposed to withhold it. That's what that document is. Their job is to ask for it, not to harass you and go through all this other stuff like the midwives will get into panic mode and say, well, you have to fill out the paperwork or else I can't do my job. But if that never happens, then the IRS doesn't know anything about any kind of information on anybody that they need to tax. So that's kind of the trick there. Now, of course, this went into the interesting question. You now have two kids who don't have social security numbers. What's going to happen when they apply for jobs or when they apply for driver's licenses, which I already know that one doesn't require a social security number, even though the form has it there and it doesn't make it look like it's optional. And they will give you the Inquisition if you don't fill it out. I tried that once. But what is, I guess, in the future, do you think, do you know, or have you gotten passports for your kids yet? I know usually at that age, people don't have passports, but have you gone through any of that process? Are you worried about driver's licenses? Are you worried about jobs?
Yes, yes, yes. And yes, and yes. To all of those things. We didn't know what was going to come up in all of the adventures that we were about to go on as a family without, you know, identity and citizenship information for the girls. So we decided we were going to try and apply for a passport. A passport is a document that establishes both identity and citizenship at the same time. It's a very powerful document. And when we called up the passport agency and spoke to whoever you can talk to, they said that you absolutely have to have a social and you absolutely have to have a birth certificate in order to do that. But once I started reading the information on their website, I found a page that had described secondary means of establishing identity and secondary means of establishing citizenship. And these are a list of examples of documents that can be used to apply for a passport in lieu of having either one of the two documents that my children do not have. And I thought, maybe is that for me? Is that for somebody else? I don't know. We decided to try. And so we started documenting all of the things that we could that would establish this identity and citizenship. And that came with the homemade birth certificate from the birthing center. It came with getting a We did a baptism. We got a baptismal certificate. There's a form called a birth affidavit that the passport administration provides. We got that as well. We got witness signatures. They provide you a witness form. So I'm so-and-so, and I witness that I know this child was born to this so-and-so's as their mother and father. And we filled that out and got it notarized. We did announcement cards. We had passport photos made. We even did a family Bible record. We did everything because we had no idea what it was going to take, right? And what happened was
two forms, what, right?
What were you going to say?
So they asked for two of these things, and I think, and you just threw everything you possibly could at them.
They don't specify how many you have to have. So that was the looming confusion for me. Is like, oh my God, is it all of them? Is it none of them? What if I can't get one? So we did everything that we possibly could for the first one. And our application was denied. We got a letter in the mail saying, I'm sorry, but you didn't provide a social or a birth certificate. And so you need to send in these documents until we can accept it. And we have a trip that we've already bought tickets for, international, going to see my wife's side of the family in Sweden just in a couple months coming up. And my wife says, you need to figure this shit out. So, and this is the whole reason I wanted to bring up this mythology. If I tried to play the system, right, or maybe tried to activate some of the systems of accountability in place, put some pressure on these bureaucrats, they probably would have dug their heels in, and I would have been a casualty of their bureaucratic process, and it never would have happened. But I didn't. I actually called them up and got a human on the phone, and I spoke to the human in the machine, and I asked for their supervisor, and I asked for their supervisor's supervisor until I could get no higher. And then I said, look, I'm a father. This is my daughter. We're about to travel. I'm afraid that I'm going to be a casualty in the bureaucratic process, and we're not going to be able to make it on this trip because she doesn't have a social or a birth certificate. Will you help me? I need someone to write a letter to whoever is processing this application and tell them to look at all of the evidence for identity and citizenship that I've sent in, because they just sent me this. And it says, you didn't send us in the typical things that I stamp, and so I don't know what to do. And this person said, yeah, absolutely. I'm already halfway done writing it. Sent out the email. The hold was taken off our passport application process the next day. And we received our passport in a week. But it didn't Amazing. Happen because I tried to play the system and the rules and the game. It happened because I actually engaged a totally different story. And that story is based off the belief that none of this machinery turns without the organic gears of each of our individual humans' participation. You can't get rid of the human element as much as we become machine, and like as much as we become the systematic person, the bureaucrat, the human is still there. And you can't forget that, because it's all powerful. And that's why systems go down overnight and spring back up. It's the people who are doing it. And we can't forget that. It's not, there is no government in real life. There's four walls right. and a bunch of people who are doing the controlling thing that we're doing. But it's people. And the hearts are still there. The minds are still there. And people usually who they don't feel that they're helping people at all. And so you give them an opportunity to actually do something gratifying, gives their life meaning. And a lot of people will jump on it, bureaucrat or not. And that was a very empowering experience as well. And of course, after a year, my daughter, Jessica, had ripped the page out of the passport. And so we had to reapply. And we're like, oh no, what are we going to do? But that was at the exact time we had to get the second passport for my youngest daughter, Nora. And I don't even think we had half of the documents that we sent in the previous time. We sent in just probably a couple of them, and we didn't even get a letter or a call. We just got accepted. I have the two passports here as well. So it wasn't as difficult as I thought it would be. And so it helped to have the sight of having done it twice to be able to tell that it really wasn't that precise or serious of a process. It was a lot more relaxed than I thought. But the main thing that you've got to do if you want to set your kids up to not be enumerated with this, with Social Security and birth certificate at least, is, well, first of all, if you don't really have a birth certificate, you can't have a midwife or a doctor. You have to do like a free birth or have like a, maybe a doula there, but maybe even then, I think they're required. Our doula filled out, well, our doula was also a midwife, but they filled, we had a home birth for the second one, and they also filled out an application for live birth. They fill it out on your behalf. There is a birth certificate out there somewhere, even though you haven't given them a name, even though you haven't signed it, that says infant so-and-so, whatever your last name is, that's out there floating in the void, whether you use it or not, because their requirement is to fill it out on your behalf.
Right.
But you don't need it to get a passport.
Right. And you don't have to use it. So like a lot of people, they don't like, I think the Social Security number does it a lot more. I know we're going to wrap this up soon because we're going over, but this is really interesting. But the Social Security number ties you into the government even more than the certificate. But if you think about the certificate, all it really is like you had your affidavit of live birth. That's basically the same thing. It's just not on the government form. Really, all they're doing is they're saying, yeah, a new baby was born. We're gonna sign a certificate. It's almost the same as like anything the government does. They give you you get stopped for speeding. They give you a certificate that the officer saw you speeding. That's really what that is. And of course, that starts the snowball rolling into all kinds of other crap. But ultimately, you know, I think that is less. But at the same time, it's not something, you know, by forcing that on everybody, you're forcing some sort of conformity, which is not an attribute of a free society. We shouldn't force people to make sure that they all have the same type of documentation of their birth. At the end of the day, it's, hey, I'm right here. I'm a human being. That should be proof enough that I was born. You know, I don't need so are you saying I don't exist because I can't find a doctor who witnessed me being born 40 years ago? Like, that doesn't make any sense. But one other thing, and since you have the passports right there, because you said something that I've learned recently that still blows my mind. Look in your passport and see where it says that your daughter is a U.S. citizen.
Is this, I'm not going to read all this, but is the conclusion that it never says that anywhere in there?
It never says that anywhere in there. It says nationality, which I've come to understand from a few people, the key difference between, and this goes into legalese again, the difference between nationality and citizenship is nationality is defined as your, I guess your highest allegiance is to the United States government. So that's your nationality, and that's therefore they give you the passport. Citizenship is, and I know there's, you've got the 14th Amendment that says everybody is a citizen of both the state and the country, but a citizen is, you don't need to be a citizen. And you can be both a citizen and not a citizen at the same time, almost by declaration. Because what a citizen is we talked about exercising the privileges of the government, receiving Social Security, voting, all these other things. These are things that citizens do as a participation in something, right? But just as, you know, you go to the gym and you get a membership, you're a citizen of the gym because you can go and use their gym as a citizen of the gym, right? It's a privilege that you have access to. But at the same time, you go, you leave the gym and you go grocery shopping. You are not grocery shopping as a citizen of the gym. You are grocery shopping as the individual who you are, and you're not exercising any privileges of that gym. So your citizenship does not matter at that point. And I think that's very interesting to me, because it kind of shows this differentiation. Now, again, I've read it a couple times, and just like with all this stuff, it's so much information, and there's so many statutes and case law and everything else that goes into it. I might be mixing this up with some of the mythology, but I've seen enough to understand that there, even though I might not be able to explain all the differences the way they are, I understand that there is some degree of difference. And I probably can't even say all the consequences of that, but I think that's extremely, extremely interesting, you know, for all of this. If you look, I saw somebody say something about there's a green passport, a green U.S. passport that they said was for, I don't know, it was more into the Patriot mythology. So I went and looked it up, and there actually is a green U.S. passport, and it's issued to refugees. There is a green U.S. passport. It's, I don't know if it gets you different privileges or something, or, you know, if you have to go through a different process when you cross the border in and out, but it is a U.S. passport, and it is given to non-U.S. citizens. So I found that very interesting, but I don't think that's entirely, you know, the Patriot mythology of, you know, oh yeah, you just say you're not a citizen and you go apply for that instead. But it is absolutely very interesting, because it's not something we think about all the day, you know, all the time. And when we hear it or see it, any information about it is just like, wow, that's totally different. That's interesting. And we look it over as if like, oh, well, that's just for like some special cases. But I think there is more to it, because it shows that everything that we thought was, we all have to conform to this. No, there actually are exceptions. And just because there's one exception, that disproves, there's this argumentative theory that, you know, if I can say all apples are red, all I need is one green apple to prove that all apples are red is false, right? So everybody must have a driver's license. Everybody must have a passport, a blue passport with a social security number and a birth certificate. All you need is one example to prove that that is not true. And once you discover that there are green apples, well, okay, they're not all red. I wonder what other colors there are. I wonder what other types of freedom I can exercise in this country without a birth certificate or a social security number or a driver's license or, you know, all these other things that the government has. I wonder if it is possible to survive completely without them. Of course, they wouldn't like that, but
there are some drawbacks. Let me know if you want me to share.
Yeah, absolutely.
So one, you don't get to claim these kids as a dependent on your tax return. You don't get the tax care credit. Two, the requirement to have a social security number is for government benefits. If you are on welfare, if you use government services, they will require you to have a social for most of them. Also, when they come of age, in order to have a bank account, the customer identification program, which is part of the Patriot Act, which was just re-signed into law, requires a bank to get a social from you in order to open a bank account. And all banks everywhere in the world, virtually, except for there's a few countries, maybe Morocco and Liechtenstein, where you are required to also give whatever the equivalent is. You have to give a tax ID or they can't accept you, because here comes the US government. Also, if you get a job, you are required to give your social security number. So this is a really complicated topic, but the gist of it is that an employee will have the IRS breathing down their neck sending in notices that they have to keep asking you for your social and doing backup withholding for your taxes if you don't give it. And there's a requirement in Texas to get a social as well, because they're trying to track people who are not paying their
child support tickets.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. So there are requirements. The major requirements that I have found, the drawbacks that I have found, is work is going to be an issue, traditional employment, and having a bank account, which is almost a modern day necessity. Right. Now, my kids are 4 and 1. So by the time that they're going to be needing to do that, I'd say at minimum is going to be 12 years from now. And I'd say at maximum is going to be at least when they're 18. So I'm really hoping that we can make some change between now and then. I'm hoping that the Patriot Act, which was supposed to be temporary, will expire, and we'll put the pressure on that. And I'm hoping also that some of these requirements for employment will be able to change, or maybe we will have enough crypto technology to where we'll have a much more viable workaround. But what I've done is what I wished would have been done for me, had my parents even been aware or cared. And that is at least given my daughter the opportunity.
Right.
To either live unenumerated or to fight that civil rights battle, that constitutional battle, which she doesn't have. Once you
or
get
to make
social,
their own decisions.
Back. Exactly.
When they're, you know, when they're old enough to need that. Now, okay, there's two interesting things. Because, okay, so a lot of people listening to this show are of the mindset, I don't want to pay any taxes, therefore I don't care what kind of deductions I get. So that privilege is right. No big deal. When it comes to the banks, and Dave Champion's talked about this a lot, that when you go to a bank, they tell you they need your social security number. But when they type it into their computer, they're not putting it into a box called social security number. They're putting it into a box called taxpayer ID number.
Right.
So I wonder if it would be possible for your daughters to get a tax ID without a social. That didn't work?
Well, unless you're a foreigner with a green card who's not a citizen, which you would get a different kind of tax ID, but a tax ID for an American citizen or for whatever is a social security number. There are people who claim that they can use different forms of tax ID. I've also heard mixed results.
Okay. So there's another one that I want to give you, and I want to preempt this with a caveat that I did try this once. I did try to get a driver's license in Nevada with this exception. I took this law. I'll tell you the story in a second. It is Title 31 of the CFR, Section 1.32, Use and Disclosure of Social Security Numbers. In general, an individual shall not be denied any right, benefit, or privilege provided by law by a component because of such individual's refusal to disclose his social security number. Now, to me, that says, well, no, you should have access to full privileges granted by the government, regardless of whether or not you have a social security number. But I have tried this, and it was interesting because I printed this law out. I was extremely nice to the clerk. She was extremely nice too. She was, you know, like your story about getting the passport. Like, I talked to her like a human being. Hey, I'm just trying to be nice. I want to try a different approach with this. I have a federal law here. Well, now I realize it's a federal regulation, which I understand is different than a law. At the time, I thought it was a law that says I don't have to give you my social security number, and you cannot deny me the privilege of a driver's license. And she was like, oh, wow, this is really interesting. And she took it to her manager, and her manager came out just irate. Like, what is this trash you are bringing in here? Get out of here. I never want to see you again. Kind of attitude. And I thought that was fascinating. Like, why? Like, what set her off, right? I brought in a federal law that explained to me please, why this doesn't apply here and why I need to give you the social. So totally, you know, mixed results. I've also heard that pre 9/11, it was very easy to go into a bank and say, give me an account without a social security number, which is also very interesting, because if you ever get into a fight with the IRS and they claim you owe them money, they can go into your bank account and take whatever they want out, but only if that bank account has a taxpayer ID on it that matches their taxpayer ID. If it has a different, if it has, you know, if you got a tax ID for your business and the bank is under your social, those are separate. They cannot get into that bank account. If the bank account has no social security number on it, which you can't do these days, then they just can't touch that account. Doesn't matter if it has the first and same first and last name and address and everything else, they just can't touch the account. So 9/11 changed a lot of things in so many different ways. It changed in the banking world too. But anyways, I just wanted to throw that out there for anybody else who wants to dig into some of this information. Take the experiment to the next level. Do so at your own risk. Don't come back and ask me to pay your legal bills. but awesome. All right. Well, I know we're way over our time for the show today, but I really want to thank you, because this has been a ton of amazing information. This is, like I said, this is sort of the thing that really brought me into this whole liberty movement and kind of woke me up to the idea that we don't all have to be exactly the same. We don't have to follow this system that's laid out in front of us, where we go to school, we get a job, we get married, we retire just when we're old enough to die, and then that's it. We don't have to be a part of that. And you know, it's been proven so many different ways by so many different people. And now I think it's time that we can really all start putting this together. We can all start acting on this. We can all start saying, hey, we want to opt out of the system. We understand that this whole government bureaucracy, like, yeah, government might do a couple things right, but let's opt into the things that we like and stay away from the things that we don't like. We shouldn't be forced to participate in every aspect of government, because a lot of it is just not something that we agree with within our lifestyle or within our personalities or within our morals and ethics. And that's very, very important. Otherwise, we're living under tyranny. We're being forced to participate in things that we don't agree with. We're being forced to pay for things we don't agree with. And that's absolute tyranny. People are afraid of living under chaos and anarchy and all these other things, but that's, you know, because of the things, oh, where there's all these warlords are going to come along and rob us and there will be no safety. That's the system we have now. It's just been so normalized that it doesn't seem fearful to us anymore. It's we're just in this mentality of comply, go along with the whole thing, and everything's going to be fine.
It's like going in a multi-generational abusive environment.
Absolutely. Can't right see back it to your point. Right back to your point about abusive relationships. That's exactly what it is.
Imagine if I said to my wife, you're not allowed to drive to the store. And if you don't ask my permission, or if you go, even though I tell you you can't, then I'm going to lock you in your room. Imagine if I said that. But that's the way that a driver's license works.
Right. And if you don't imagine get in there voluntarily,
you can divorce me. Yeah. You can divorce me. But only if you're already in another relationship with somebody that I Ooh. Recognize. Well, that's the way that
Wow. Somebody that I approve of. That is a very good analogy of citizenship. You have to, yeah. Wow.
The list goes on. The parallels are, they're not just parallels. There may actually be a causal relationship. It may stem from the systemic waters that we swim in. Systemic abuse may come first, and then domestic violence is kind of the personification of that, how it expresses itself in the household once we're subjected to that. I mean, most people, like if you look at child beaters or wife beaters, they grew up in that household. They were beaten themselves as children. They're just repeating a pattern that goes on and on. And we've grown up in tyranny and control, right, with a smiling face, even though we have a constitution and a declaration. We have 35 million laws, and those are permission slips with consequences and punishments for everything from being born to driving to the store to catching a fish. We're red taped ourselves into a corner It's more laws than the laws of physics. I mean, where does it end? Eventually, it's going to be unsustainable. I mean, the control, you just get to, well, where we are now.
And like, so as you said this, like another just absolutely horrible thought popped into my mind of when you see your dad beating your mom as a child and you somehow justify that in your head as that's what's normal. That is what happens when you see the police kill somebody on TV or on the internet, whatever. They kill some, that is like, that is, because we look at the police or the government as a parent figure, you know, somebody who's going to solve all our problems and figure out what's right and wrong, the authority figure. And they're out there breaking the law and committing violence against other people who are our brothers and sisters, our mothers. That is us seeing that, and somehow we're expected to still put our faith in this system as, yeah, well, he's not perfect, but he's still my dad, right? I don't want anybody to think that's my dad, but I know that a lot of people go through. I'm not talking about my dad, but I know people do go through this, and it's horrific, and we are being forced to go through that as a society.
We are. Imagine you see your kid being beat up in the lunch line by some bully for his lunch money, right? And you, what would you do? Would that be okay? No, absolutely not. You'd stop it, say, hey, listen, you don't get to take his money. He can give it to you if he wants to. It's his to give, you know?
Son, but then you talk about taxes. The
IRS and people shrivel up. Oh, well, you got to pay your taxes. There's three things that parents hope that to teach their kids not to do. And that's don't hit people, don't take their shit, and don't lie. And when you look at our government, it's ubiquitous.
That's all they do.
Yeah. It's ubiquitous. Absolutely. So it's really hard to model and say, oh, well, daddy condones that, but he doesn't condone it in his own household. The hypocrisy undermines your legitimacy as a parent.
Absolutely. All right, Nick, it's been awesome. Right, I know, brother. We could continue talking all night. This is really great stuff. But thank you again so much for joining me on the show. Everybody, you watching this now, listening to this on your podcast, remember to subscribe. Head on over to taxationistheft.cards, get one of these really cool hats or one of the t-shirts or anything else we've got there. And absolutely, if you like this episode, share it with all your friends and tell them taxation is theft, because it is. All right, I will see you guys tomorrow night with another episode, and we're going back to back. We've got episodes almost every weeknight for the next month lined up, so it's going to be an amazing month. I'll see you guys tomorrow. Taxation is theft.
You're the man. Thank you, Dan.